Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to the Irish Farmers Journal podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm Stephen Robb, and you're very welcome along to the Tillage Podcast. It's currently Thursday morning, the 4th of November. I have a cup of coffee in one hand and a freshly printed Irish Farmers Journal newspaper in the other. And as always, I'm joined by my colleagues, Andy Doyle and Siobhan Walsh, to discuss all the latest tillage news and others from this week's paper and indeed from online. But first, we're going to take a look around the country to see what has been happening over the past 7 days. And look, it's clear to see from looking at our network of Sencrop weather stations that it has been a wet one, with a few particularly wet days and nights over the weekend. Looking across the country, we see rainfall figures from the past 7 days ranging anywhere from between 54 millimetres up to 110 millimetres, depending on what part of the country. The south seemed to have got it particularly bad over the weekend, but very few places escaped any rain at all. For many, that has put an end to field work for the foreseeable. In drier parts of the country, they've been able to get going just today, really, over with the help of a couple of settled days. We have the last of potato harvesting going on at the moment. Look, yields are, depends on who you talk to, yields are very good or yields are mediocre, and depending on the area and depending on the stress the crop experienced throughout the year. The last of the maize harvest, I would argue, is also coming out in certain parts of the country, whereas beet is just about getting going. And indeed, we've heard some very mixed reports about the beet crop, which we will get into in later podcasts. Andy, I'm going to pull yourself in here. You've been taking a look at the monthly rainfall figures for Met Éireann over October.
Yes, indeed, Stephen. And they vary pretty much on reported stories up to now. We know that the guys down in the south, particularly across Cork, they've got a lot more rainfall than normal. It probably started earlier in the month with Moor Park having got a big spill. But in the later part of the month, you have places like Rochestown Point, which would be reflective to a fair degree of the lads across East Cork, running up a monthly total of 187. Cork Airport running up 197. Moor Park, on the other hand, while it started wet, finished up with 125. And I think that's probably indicative of that. If you just take that one county, in any county, it was tended to be wetter by the coast and drier inland a bit. Johnstown Castle in Wexford would normally have 122 mil, or that is its average figure for October. Last month, it was 193.5. And contrast that with the North Leinster area, and the Dublin stations running in between 75 and 80 mil for the month. And that's indicative of how easy or difficult it will be for people to get much more field work done in the next few days and weeks.
Andy, a question that's been asked of me several times over the past few days is, with the notable decrease in temperatures in the soil and in the ground, is it enough to kill the aphids that are out there?
The quick answer to that is no, and I would say no with a capital N. It's pretty definite that it would not kill aphids. What the cold weather does is that it tends to make them migrate from plant to soil if they need shelter. But I would say that you wouldn't even get that much migration given the temperatures that we've had. You know, we're not really down around freezing. We've touches of frost some mornings, all right, but not at freezing. It's generally accepted that the aphids that are of concern to us will survive in the soil at about -8 degrees, so are down to -8 degrees. So don't expect that they're going to be gone away. But what it will do is that it certainly slows or even stops reproduction. And if you stop reproduction, then you decrease the likelihood of winged aphids being produced on the plants, which will give rise to further spread. And that's the same premise that we've been using for years, that once you get into November, the possibility of further spread is minimal, and it would only be kick-started if we happen to get a very mild spell coming at some point through November, December or January.
Okay, Andy, I suppose just whenever we're in the fields at the moment, we have been asked another question. I think every member of the team have noticed it, really. There's some very forward winter oilseed rape crops out there at the moment. I suppose growers are wondering, what is the correct management approach to these crops?
Yes, Stephen, I'll come straight in on that one. We get a lot of comments on it. It doesn't happen every year. It's a reflection of the two things that we talked about weeks and weeks ago on the podcast. One is soil temperature and air temperature, I suppose, with it. And the other one is the inevitability of nitrogen release in recent weeks with water, rain hitting warm soil, so that these crops are kind of, in a sense, the whip is being whipped on them, and they've responded accordingly. But what do you do with them? You know, you have crops out there that are 12, 14, 15 inches high at this point in time, and people are wondering what to do. The question is being asked, you know, should you graze them? Should you top them? And God only knows what else. The way I would look at it is that the foliage that's generated now in the autumn on these crops is a very useful part of next year's nutrition, because those leaves and petioles, etc., they have taken up nutrients from the ground that can subsequently be used to drive the spring canopy, which means a lower fertilizer requirement for spring, providing the canopy can be kept in situ, which really means that the pigeons don't come in on top of them and graze them off. But pigeons would be highly unlikely to come into a crop that would be that well established, because they don't like landing in a full canopy, because when their feathers get wet, they have difficulty taking off. So it's always been one of the main deterrents for pigeon grazing. But they are forward crops. They'll be strong crops, they'll be bulky crops. And certainly, I think people should seriously consider getting growth regulation of some sort onto them in order to put on the handbrake and slow them down. I would always be very careful about putting growth regulator on a crop that wouldn't have a strong canopy, because you can freeze it at a lesser level than it should be. But once the canopy is big and full and strong, then you can certainly afford the growth regulator, and you need it to try and prevent those crops from becoming too lush and too strong, with the risk of lodging next spring.
Yeah, absolutely, Andy. It's rare that we see such a common management problem, I suppose, which would has been rare for this time of year over the past number of years. So widespread across the country. I mean, even crops up here in the northwest are incredibly far forward. But look, we will move on, and we'll move away from the fields for just one moment. Two big topics which we have focused heavily on in the Tillage Podcast over the past month or two has been fertilizer and markets. And this week's going to be no different, because some of the movements that are happening in these markets are just incredible. And just a word on markets from this week. I mean, certainly the growers we've been talking to are still struggling to even get a quote, never mind actually purchase or take delivery of some fertilizer.
Yeah, look, it's extremely hard to get quotes at the minute. And I think, you know, people have nearly took a break from the fertilizer market at the minute, farmers anyway. And look, maybe it's no harm as well. If you're looking at prices every week, it'll it wouldn't be, it's not a positive thing to be looking at. So look, it's hard to get quotes at the minute.
Okay, Andy, over to you. Grain markets, we're seeing some truly astronomical record-breaking prices in the wheat market at the moment.
Yes, indeed, Stephen. I think both sides of the Atlantic, prices have reached levels that haven't been seen before on the futures markets particularly. You know, when we were going through harvest, I think we were looking at prices in the order of 250, 260 euro a ton. Those prices for product in store today are up on and above 290 a ton. Import prices into the country for wheat and barley have either met or passed 300 euro a ton. And as things seem to be going at the moment, it's not impossible that we would see 300 euro a ton in the price range of selling Irish grain for the next couple of, within the next couple of weeks somewhere. It's possible. I'm not saying it'll happen. It's interesting to note that markets are weakening again today, having weakened a good bit yesterday, but that's kind of normal. It happens every week. And as we kind of get into Thursday, now we're looking at something that's lower than it was a few days ago, but quite likely it'll be much higher again in a few days' time. It's just incredible the way these prices continue to strengthen. I might even add, strengthen to the point of being worrying at every aspect.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. So obviously, grain is still being bought around the world at these prices. At what point does the market overheat? At what point do we price ourselves out of the market? I mean, is this uncharted territory?
It's uncharted territory to some degree. But unlike some previous times when we had high prices in Ireland and in Europe, basically the equilibrium was set by something that came in from somewhere else in the world. This time, there isn't anything anywhere else in the world that's cheaper that will come in. The overall supply of grain to trade in the world is not keeping pace with overall production. And as a consequence, there's kind of very little surplus there for the moment. But there is always a risk that something happens. There's a risk that, you know, a political decision gets made somewhere for a totally different reason that can have a consequence of allowing something into Europe that currently can't come in, you know, maybe protected by a tax or a tariff or something like that. And ballpark, everything changes very, very quickly. It's just when you're up in these prices, price levels, the risks can be big also. You know, currently we're seeing quite a big gap still between current price levels and new crop price levels, which are kind of in excess of 50 euro a ton. Again, as we move into next year, that gap is going to narrow. So one way or the other, either the next year's crop increases in value or this year's crop decreases in value, or a combination of both. This time last year, we had the exact same situation. And basically what happened was that this year's crop, the 2021 harvest crop, increased in value to the previous year's level. Will that happen once again? If it does, it'll be an absolutely unique scenario, almost on a century basis, not to talk of a decade basis, to have prices rising for two consecutive harvests.
Yeah, that's incredible. But I mean, the issue is more so concerns, isn't it, as opposed to actual supply issues?
Yes, supply is tight for sure. You know, there's no major big surpluses, but nonetheless, you know, there are surpluses. There are surpluses, or stocks, I should say. There are stocks in the order of 250 million tons of wheat and another, the pretty much the same for maize. So it's not a scarcity issue. It's what price will it take to free up and make available some of those stocks around the world. But the problem is more logistics and the cost of transport. Can I get it? If I buy it, then can I transport it? And all of these things are generating the pressures that we're seeing today. So, you know, we're now looking at a situation where freight, bulk freight, will have trebled in relatively recent weeks. It was a little bit higher before that. but now it's trebled, and it's not the trebling that's the biggest problem. It's, can I get the boat? And it's these uncertainties that are really driving the market. So you'll pay a lot more for anything that you know you can get your hands on. And it's driving prices at a level that, I'm not saying they're not good for farmers, but they're not good. They're certainly not good for the people that are using it. It's not that easy as a farmer to capitalize on those prices, because the bulk of the grain was sold at harvest at prices that are considerably lower than them, or than what they are today.
Yeah. Okay. Look, Andy, no doubt we'll be coming back to this likely next week, going at this trajectory. And just on freight costs, Siobhan does have a piece in this week's paper just highlighting the impacts of current freight costs on feed costs. So be sure to check that out. But I suppose, guys, I want to pull this all together now, because that's what we've done in this week's newspaper on the tillage spread. So on page 44 and 45, Andy, you have a section looking at the anticipated tillage margins for the coming season, pretty much based on current prices. Just in a nutshell, explain to us the methodology behind this. Essentially, it's an adapted model of the Chagas crop cost and returns for the coming season. Explain to us the methodology. What has been changed here? What are you basing the prices off?
Stephen, it's not even adapted. It is Chagas costs and returns. That's basically what it is. And using the basic parameters of production there, be it fertilizer quantities, contractor charges, chemical costs, fertilizer costs, etc., in the mix. And we've gone in and looked at what elements of cost seem set to rise for the coming season based on what we know today. And the easy one in there is fertilizer. We know it's going up, but we don't, of course, know for certain what it's going to cost us. We will anticipate an increase in chemical costs, particularly because of, again, the same logistical issues rather than the actual product itself going up. It's just going to cost more to get it to the market, and that means it may cost us more. We might anticipate an increase in cost on the contractor side and anything to do with diesel, etc. But we have no idea what that would be. So we didn't include it, but acknowledged the fact that it could very well be there when the time comes. And then we went in and we priced fertilizer at what we would call the estimated current price levels. And I stress estimated because we have no way of knowing whether those prices will be higher or lower when the time comes, and they could be either when that time comes.
It might just be useful for our listeners to run through those prices just real quick. I have them here in front of me, just based on table one fertilizer prices. In on the pages, we have CAN plus sulfur at 600 per tonne. We have 13,620 at 860. We have 10,1020 at 830. We have 50% K at 800. We have 0730 at 900. Urea 850 and ASN at 640.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that the figures that were used last year were ones that were given by Chagas, and that's what they estimated the costs on. And they have CAN plus S in, for example, at 235. And that certainly was a spring price for CAN, but there would have been a number of growers that would have bought CAN kind of sub 190 in the previous fall. So for them, the consequences of the cost increases this year would be even bigger. We guesstimate that they are relatively real prices in today's market. Getting them could be a different kettle of fish. Getting your hands on supplies could be even more difficult. I know some people are currently or have currently bought 2021 stocks at a higher price than 2021, but a lot less than those numbers that are there today. But that's just the good business of farming for those that can do it. So against those prices, basically, we have costed the exact same quantity of nutrient using the same products this year versus last. And in the case of winter wheat, for example, the fertilizer cost would be up 492. Winter barley up 415 euro a hectare. Spring barley up 420 euro a hectare. You know, they are phenomenally big increases in your fertilizer bill. And basically, they would erode virtually all margin or quickly push a poor crop into negative margin. And basically, the question we've posed, based on the fertilizer prices and the chemical prices that we think may be in the market, we've asked the question, you know, how should you respond to these? Do you just go out and spend the same amount of money on fertilizer? Or do you say, well, look at, if I'm spending an additional 500 euro just to make sure that I get the same quantity of fertilizer on as last year on a winter wheat crop, if I cut the rate, what would the consequence for yield be? And it's interesting when you watch and look at the shape of the nitrogen response curves, you know, we would commonly say that the last 20% of the recommended rate is probably only given 5% of the yield. And against that background, you would be spending almost 300 euro to get 100 euros worth of grain. And that defies gravity to think of it in when you think of it in that way. So what we had done is we've gone out and we've kind of cut significantly the rates of fertilizer to where we can have a minimal consequence for yield, whilst trying to keep the overall margin as high as we can. And it's against that basis that we did a rerun of the standard Chagas margins. But of course, we were forced to use lower basic yield levels across all crops, with the exception of beans, because when you use 20% less nitrogen, and basically what we did is we put in 20% less fertilizer, that's N, P and K, on the winter crops, 20% less P and K on the spring crops, but we didn't drop the nitrogen rates on the spring crops by 20%, for the simple reason that if you take something like malting barley, because protein and making the protein grades is such an important part of the margin, if you play around too much with less nitrogen, you may not make the grades that you need to make to get the margin, the additional margin of the premium on the crop. And also for spring barley, it is very sensitive to lesser nitrogen amounts at a given time. And if it's not on, then you can't make up the difference. So the cuts on spring barley, I think feed barley I used, I think minus 15% on nitrogen. And on malting barley and oats, I think I used minus 7% on nitrogen, but minus 20% on P and K, all to try and get that fertilizer bill down. I know and commented that the natural reaction that people would have would be to take a P and K holiday and put out all the nitrogen as a way of containing costs. But like my view would be, who knows where the next couple of years are going to take us. In all too often in the past, we have seen high grain prices followed by low grain prices, but the high fertilizer prices that were caused by the high grain prices didn't fall for 4 or 5 years. So to be caught in a situation where your yield is now limited by P and K scarcity means you get very poor value for the nitrogen you're applying. And I would make one other comment, and that is if the world, and the world is asking this same question, about the value that you will get from fertilizer against these very high prices. If the world were to ease back on the throttle a bit and produce 5% less grain, it would be one of the best ways that I can think of to ensure that the price of grain would carry the residual price of fungicide or cost of of fertilizer, because it would basically push the world into deficit.
Yeah, okay. Now look, the table, I'm just looking at it here now. For the sake of the podcast, we're not going to go through every single crop. So we would definitely advise you all to buy a copy of this week's paper and read through it, because there's a bit of thinking involved, there's a bit of digestion involved in the figures there. But it's particularly a good guide for potential margins over the coming season. But in the interest of time, we're going to move on. We're going to move away from direct tillage for a second here. One thing that we cannot get away from in the media this week is COP26. And indeed, that's probably synonymous of the whole issue of climate change. It's here and it's here to stay, and there's no getting away from it. Siobhan, yourself and myself have been listening into COP26 this week. We see a global pledge of a 30% reduction in methane emissions. Ireland's looking like it could be around 10% or so. And of course, that's dominating the airwaves and its impact on agriculture and so on and so forth. But in all of the debates and in all of the conversations, there's no real talk about tillage and the role that tillage plays in the entire agricultural climate ecosystem as such. And indeed, even Siobhan, you were at the Ballinakilin Mart earlier on this week for one of Charlie McConnell's, Minister McConnell's CAP tours. And indeed, very little conversation about about tillage. And I believe there was actually no tillage representation there at all.
Yeah, look, Stephen, we're kind of copped out at the minute, aren't we? We're just, methane is dominating the COP agenda. And I mean, no one is talking about the solutions that are out there. And tillage is one of the solutions. And we know that, isn't it, a hectare of tillage, its footprint is 1.18 tonnes, it's four times lower than beef, eight times lower than dairy, and three quarters of the emissions on tillage farms are coming from livestock. But yet we're not hearing about massive funding going to go into tillage farms. And look, you said it there, I was in Ballinakilin Mart, and it's Charlie's tour of the country on his CAP consultation. And first of all, we got a CAP lesson from Charlie to start off with, or from Minister McConnell, and Minister Hackett was there as well. And we got a lecture from Minister Hackett as well. And farmers were very frustrated. At one point, the minister said that farmers need to roll up their sleeves. That's
certainly one way to infuriate an already aggravated farmer audience.
Yeah, people were clearly frustrated. They were growing impatient because they were listening to a lot of talking and they weren't being listened to. But eventually the crowd did get going when they were allowed to speak. But, you know, when I say we're not hearing tillage as the solution, at the same time, in Ballinakilin March yesterday, we were in County Leash. It's a mixed farming county. There's loads of livestock, plenty of tillage in it. And I saw an odd few grain farmers in the crowd, and one mixed farmer spoke, who, you know, he has straw and grain for his animals. But I didn't hear anyone specifically representing the grain sector there yesterday. So in many ways, we're our own worst enemy, because if we don't go to these things, in the tillage sector, then, you know, we're not heard. And the more that you go to these things, the more you're heard. And, you know, maybe that's something that we need to look at in the sector as well. There was no specific representation there yesterday. And if that representation isn't there when the minister comes, he's going around to all the counties. Now, maybe there was tillage representation at other counties, but he's going to all the counties looking for consultation on CAP, and the wasn't tillage farmers there to say their bit. So that's something that we have to be conscious about as well.
Yeah, I mean, Andy, you always would have said in the past that sometimes we can be our own worst enemies in the tillage sector in terms of standing up and speaking up for ourselves, and I suppose look where that has gotten us.
Even sometimes, Stephen, it's a matter of just being seen and being seen in numbers. You know, we fail to gather as a sector. We fail to gather for any single event anywhere in the country, so that the importance of the sector can be measured in some way, form or fashion, just by attendance. If we won't do it, then we can't expect anybody else to do it for us. Or maybe that's exactly the opposite way around. Maybe we do always expect somebody else to do it for us, and that won't happen.
And tillage has such a good story to tell. I mean, it could really help this country in fighting the battle against climate change and in emissions reductions. And there's loads of opportunity as well. Like when we hear about fertilizer costs and everything, there's loads of other things that we can do on our farm to work with the livestock sector. And we need to be more proactive as a sector in making our sector a success and shouting about the good story that it has to tell in helping to reduce emissions.
in that same conversation, though, we have to kind of always be somewhat careful. If as we kind of strive in the sector to act as a really absorbent carbon store, because we know that the worn tillage ground will very readily take on more organic matter and more carbon, we have to consider what the consequences of that would be for what appears to be very low carbon emission levels currently. Could we end up, by trying to help the overall agricultural sector, could we end up being measured higher as an emitter than we are today, because we're doing things that are shown to be fundamentally right? It's ironic that we do not have any of these numbers, that we have no answers to these questions. Indeed, one of the big reasons why tillage was not really analysed in the KPMG report is that there is no straightforward figure for tillage emissions other than the one we have for those mixed tillage and livestock farms. And Siobhan, as you rightly say, that figure of 1.08 tonnes a hectare, we're given that three quarters of that is from the livestock that's on those farms, but we don't have those absolute figures for the tillage sector. And it's not right that we don't have them, because we don't know which way to move the sector if we don't have them.
And we have it for the other sectors. Like, it's extremely frustrating, and I know it's extremely complicated as well. Look, I, as part of my job in sustainability, I'm trying to figure out these carbon footprints, and I know every crop is different. You know, if you're ploughing, if you're direct drilling, if you had a fodder crop or whatever, it's difficult to do, but surely that should be something that we have to add, you know, available to us. We have the footprint of per litre of milk or per kg of beef, and it's something that we need. I suppose just on adding value and what tillage can do, Stephen, you had an online story about the Donegal distilleries. It's an interesting one. It might be just worth a mention.
Yeah, look, it's done surprisingly well. So it has online, and it's great to see. Look, a neighbour of mine, local grower, Peter Lynch, a good tillage farmer, has been working with assemblers of malt and barley for Bort Malt, Jim and Gareth Devaney. And basically, they've been working with two distilleries here in West Donegal, Sleeve Lee and Crawley. And basically, the two distilleries are actively trying and succeeding, actually, as of this week, in using natively grown Donegal barley within their whiskey production process. Crawley, they took in barley this year. Hopefully, it's about 30% of their total requirements. Next year, they're hoping to go to 100%. So it's really good, really positive. Nice little snippet of a story available online. And yeah, it's just good to see. And indeed, that's not unique to Donegal. There's similar stories around the country of other distilleries or breweries in that case.
We don't have the figures there, Stephen, but I think we can safely assume that whiskey has a much lower carbon footprint than the whiskey that's being produced from maize. And wouldn't it be great if we could put the carbon footprint on a bottle of whiskey like we do on or like we're going to do soon on milk cartons?
Yeah, well, look, certainly the trajectory of policy in Europe, and it has been mooted for a long time, that may become mandatory at some point in the near future.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great? Okay, in the interest of time, because I think we have officially gone over our allocated time, we're going to wrap things up. But as you can see, it's been another busy week. There's plenty more in this week's paper. So be sure to pick up a copy in shops today. And indeed, we're hoping later on today, or definitely this week, we're going to have our individual climate targets, climate emission. Emission reduction targets, I should say, published at last. So no doubt that's going to centre heavily on next week's podcast. So Andy, finally, looking at the week ahead, you have the Met Air and weather forecast open in front of you. Is there going to be any opportunities to get any field work done?
Well, probably best to describe it as this side of the weekend and the other side of the weekend, Stephen. For the rest of this week, the forecast is quite reasonable. Right up even into Monday for many parts, barring the southwest and the west. Kind of a lot more zeros than we've seen in recent times, and what's not a zero is a one. So, you know, generally not much rain in the forecast for the next number of days, but that's probably going to change Monday night into Tuesday with what must be a band of rain crossing the country, and a lot of areas kind of forecasted to get between 10 and 40 and 50 in mil on Tuesday. So that kind of would bring everything to a halt again if we get going. And indeed, people are going in places just because they haven't got some of the really big spills of recent times.
Okay, guys, that's good to hear. So does Andy. So for there, we're going to have to leave it for the week. So from Andy, Siobhan and myself, Stephen Robb, thank you all very much for listening once again. And until next week, stay safe, stay tillage farm.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at oseamalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.